going to spend the next half hour finishing up some reading, but not Saturday night at San Marcos, which I did read. And you told me on the phone about the section that you thought was possibly the most significant in the book. That's the one in which your narrator speaks to the creative writing people about, you can express better than I, but about the loneliness of the craft of writing. Is that the part that you were referring to?
Yes. I think he gives two talks. One of them is a summary. It's a sort of an artificial summary. You know, it's what everyone thinks that you should say. But then he tells them that the one thing that he can't say is what you can never teach anyone, which is the long pull, the courage that it takes, the loneliness. These things, not only can you not teach them, but even if you could teach them, you'd scare everyone away.
But there's more to writing, too, than just the courageous aspects that you referred to, and the loneliness, the commitment. I was doing a story yesterday on James Jones.
Yes.
I had read a biography by Frank McShane of Jones, and he had some examples of Jones' first writing that he had written in the military. And it was appalling. It was just, he could not spell, he could not punctuate. It was amateurish, as though a 12-year-old were trying to write something completely beyond his ability to grasp. So there are technical aspects of the craft of writing that must be mastered, and it seems to me some of these things can be taught.
Oh, sure. Sure.
Well, you can't teach the courage, and you can't teach
understanding. But it would be similar to what you do in broadcasting. You could teach someone how to set up microphones and how to confront interviewees and that sort of thing. But when you really get down to it, you know, the great broadcasters of our time, you can't teach anyone to do that. It's a genius that you either have or you don't have. I suppose you teach up to a certain level of technical things. And when you say that about James Jones, it sends a chill through my body because I think of how many students that I might have had that would have seemed to be awkward, immature, you know, not particularly potential. And then once they get away on their own, you know, God knows what happens. They become wonderful. Sometimes that's needed, is to get away.
Well, tell me a little bit about writing conferences. When we talked on the telephone, you had asked me if I had ever been to a writing conference,
yeah.
And I said no, I had never been to a writing conference, and that was one of the reasons that Saturday night at San Marcos was interesting to me. Apparently, of course, in the novel you have some very strong things to say about writing conferences, and not all of them good. You have obviously been to a lot of writing conferences, and are you ever going to go back after this book?
Yeah, I just signed down to do two more next summer, one at NYU and one down in the Poconos. This is not me, necessarily, in the book. The persona of the narrator is someone who is not writing, and he's teaching other people how to write. Now, I don't know if that ever really hit me while I was teaching at conferences, because I think I was always able to keep my own writing going, you know? You can develop a technique just as an actor goes on stage and performs Hamlet, then he goes off stage and he lives his life. He doesn't take it home with him. And I was able pretty much, in fact, part of this novel I wrote at writers' conferences, you know. But I think it's a metaphor. It's for any field that you're in. You sense that there are some people in the field who are starving to death. Because while they are doing what they're supposed to be doing, they really long to be doing something else. Or they are in a position where they're supposed to be. I think Graham Greene wrote a novel about a priest who was an atheist. Was it The Power and the Glory? About a priest who had lost faith. And yet he still had to carry on. He still had to perform the sacraments, you know, as if he did still have the faith. And it's that type of a metaphor of the terrible paradox that we get ourselves into, sometimes without knowing it. I'm sure that it extends into families. There are fathers and mothers who have lost the sense of being fathers and mothers, you know, and yet they still have to keep performing the symbolic role. So I would hope that this is not just seen as a spoofy, sexy, funny satire. I mean it in deadly earnest. It's, for me, it's a very strong metaphor.
Well, your narrator lost faith, apparently, but have you lost faith?
Oh, no.
No, not at all. I mean, signing up for two more conferences would either indicate that you need the income or you have not lost the faith.
Well,
or both.
It's a mystery to me how much of these. I was rereading last night for something I'm working on, Slaughterhouse-Five by Vonnegut, and he puts right in there, in the opening chapter of Slaughterhouse-Five, about how he came back from that dreadful war experience, and he taught at Iowa writers' conferences. And Vonnegut has done a lot of these things, writers' conferences. He's been at several that I've been at. Whether it does or doesn't feed one's work, I don't know. This is a great mystery to me. I know that teaching is, in my generation, has been a profession that writers have used to earn their living, sometimes with disastrous results to their work. A lot of it has to do with the way one goes at it. I think to be a writer, you have to be very strongly motivated. And there's a fine line for me between narcissism, where you're in love with yourself, and you're in love with your work, and egotism. I would like to think I was an egotist, but not a narcissist.
The writer's conference, as opposed to a formalized course of study, such as one might get in studying for an MFA in creative writing at Columbia or one of the universities.
Yes.
I would assume the writer's conferences attract a lot of hopeful amateurs. And indeed, in Saturday Night at San Marcos, you have example after example of would-be writers showing samples of their craft, none of which was very good. So tell me a little bit about the type of student who goes to a writer's conference and how he might compare to one who commits himself to, say, 3 years to get a master's degree.
Well, you mentioned Frank McShane, and he runs a fine program at Columbia. When I was very young, there were no programs, and I wanted to be a writer, and I knew that there was Iowa and there was Breadloaf, and that was it. And I went up to Breadloaf. And Robert Frost had the great kindness to tell me to get out fast. He said, "You don't belong here. You're not one of these people."
Where did he say this?
At Breadloaf, which was one of the only writers' conferences. Right. Now, since then, the last 30 years, they've proliferated. There's hardly a state that doesn't have an MFA program. The only difference, I think, in an MFA program is that you're adding on the credentials for a career. If someone feels, if they have an MFA degree, that somehow gives them a point or two ahead in the writing game, and I have a very strong opinion about that myself, but in a conference, most of the conferences I've taught at, some of them are accredited, like at NYU, they can get credits and add it towards a degree.
The writing style in Saturday Night at San Marcos is certainly, well, I guess one would have to say bizarre. Instead of using normal punctuation, of course, you use and throughout. Also, there's a kind of a biblical feel to it, where you reach a point where you quote somebody and the last sentence, there is no last sentence in your book, is usually, and she said, as it sounds almost like something out of the Bible. At any rate, why did you elect to establish in this novel such an unusual style, knowing that it might put some people off?
Don, that gets right to the heart of it. I don't think I did elect. I think it happened. I certainly didn't make a conscious choice. I was putting together these anecdotal materials, and certainly was not a conscious choice. I think that's the great curse if you start sitting around talking about style. Again, we're talking about Slaughterhouse-Five. If someone were to talk about the style of that book, I mean, it's a discombobulated, fragmentary response to the fracture of an ego that's been through a terrible war experience. But that's what tends to happen at conferences and seminars. You're not talking about style.
Of course, when you mention Vonnegut, you're talking about a writer who's been raked over the coals for his style.
Well, That's probably people are going to go at me for style. I don't care. My heart was in the metaphor. Now, whether it's successful or not, I don't know. And my vanity doesn't ride or fall with whether this book works or the next one works. Or the style, if you say biblical, I'm pleased. If the run-on style, I suppose in a way the style itself is satirical of a non-stop Joycean and Faulknerian push. But as I say, as with all things that work in art, it happened. It didn't. I didn't consciously say, I think I'm going to write a non-stop book without any commas. I'm afraid I would disappoint a seminar, you know, by saying I don't. Ultimately, I come back to the intuitive mystery of things, which is what art has to be. And how much can you teach writing? How much can you teach something like style? I don't know. I don't know. As you say, you can teach the fundamentals. You can teach the mechanics. You can meet with people on a one-on-one basis, read their manuscripts, try as sincerely as you can to give them feedback and be objective about it. Always aware that you may make mistakes, terrible mistakes, and always aware that you've got this horrible problem of occasionally coming up against mediocrity so much that it tires you, looking for kindnesses, looking for nice things to say to people. I can remember Stanislavski said in his autobiography, after he'd founded the Moscow Art Theater and then he set up a conservatory to go with it, taking in acting students, and he said, you know, any acting school, if it's to succeed, has to lie to its student. For every one talented student that you have, you've got 99 that, quite frankly, are never going to go anywhere. Now, that sounds really terrible, but I think we would know that reality in other fields.
Including literature.
Sure.
And certainly poetry.
And the arts and the media and so on. I'm sure there are schools that purport to teach people how to broadcast.
Oh, certainly. Certainly, there are commercial schools all over, and you'll see their ads in the subways.
Yeah.
With a little book of coupons, which you fill your name out and get free literature. And, be just like the big people. You can study at the Columbia School of Broadcasting, no affiliation with the CPS.
Yeah, yes.
It's been said that in the art world, that to young artists, painters, that if they want to paint, they want to draw, that they should study their masters. And it seems to me that no less can be said of people who want to become poets and become writers of prose. They could study their masters, which is why a lot of the styles we see are so derivative. But I think probably there's nothing wrong in Saturday Night at San Marcos. You have a very original style, very conscious stylistic approach. Most people do take a style, I would assume, if they want to write, and then go off on their own and do something better. So obviously the people they imitate most are they used to. I don't know if this is the case now, but you know, Hemingway is a prime example, people like that.
Yes,
but I have a feeling now that young people, and
since
I talk to so many writers, young people now are looking more toward their peers to imitate, and that names that come up almost all the time, people I talk to, are names like Raymond Carver, Ann Beatty, Tobias Wolff, people like that. And I have a feeling that that these younger writers, they're being imitated a lot these days. I don't know if that's bad, though. Do you?
No, it's not. Again, this mystery, how do you achieve your own style except through imitating others? I've got no problem with that. Imitation is part of learning, and then hopefully you pass beyond to find your own. Ultimately, as the French say, le style, c'est l'homme, style is the man. Style comes out of the organic man, and I doubt when you get up to the very greatest writers, whether Faulkner or Hemingway could tell you what their style was, that it was finally the spin-off of the life that they've lived. We know that some of them, Faulkner did teach at the University of Mississippi for a while. He taught at West Point for a while.
Did Faulkner teach at West Point?
Yeah. And Hemingway, of course, an expatriate Faulkner put in his time in Hollywood scripting some films. What the dynamics of that is, what I have done in my life and how much that contributes to my style, I don't know. It pleases me that you would say the Bible, because that's been a very powerful unconscious influence on me, but and of course there's a subtext of evangelism all through this novel, you know.
I'm sure there's a what?
A subtext of evangelism. All these writers trying to evangelize their students. Just as you'd see on Sunday morning, the evangelists, you know, trying to preach the gospel. The one thing that I feel about conferences, writing programs, that is the most positive of all is that not that it gives you a chance to meet your peers and to make contacts to get published and so forth, because I think that's trash. Occasionally, it puts you in touch with a person that makes you feel proud of your calling, of your vocation. If you can come up against someone like Muriel Rukeyser, or a few of the conferences I've taught at were Joe Heller or Kurt Vonnegut or Robertson Davies, the Canadian novelist, was, and you're reminded that this is an awfully proud profession that you're doing, because writers are very solitary, that sometimes to be reminded that it's a very noble calling, it's a very beautiful thing to do with one's life, that might be necessary. Because God knows everything else in the society is trying to make you feel the other, that it's not very good, that you're an outsider, and so on. And although we have awards in this country, I think if you compared us with certain European countries where the writer was held in a little more esteem, we wouldn't come off so well.
It seems to me also there's another benefit to a writer's conference or any gathering of writers or any place where writers go, not necessarily a formal gathering, and that is, you had mentioned that the craft of writing is a lonely, solitary existence, and I think that perhaps getting together with other writers or people who want to write might be a morale booster, because you're sharing something in common that's important.
Yes.
I'm only making an assumption.
And then you form friendships and you write letters to people in distant cities. It all depends, I suppose, on the motivation why people want to be writers in the first place. And we have, in the spectrum, people all the way from, on the one hand, Emily Dickinson, who lived a solitary life, to someone, on the other hand, like Noel Coward, who was not a solitary at all, but would get out on stage and perform his plays. I think that it's the most important thing for the writer would be for him to know himself, to know why he's writing, what he wants to do in his writing, vaguely, not specifically, in terms of the next book or something, and to keep the distinction between egotism and narcissism very clear, because what happens with this book, part of me doesn't care at all, because I'm so much involved now in the next one. And
but another part of you wants it, you want to share it, you want to read it, and you want to share what you've done and with other people. I think that's important for a writer to expose what he has done and have other people read it.
Yes, we may have too much of that today, of the difference between wanting to share, which is a good, pure word, and wanting to hustle.
Hustle?
Hustle, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Because when people go out on the road, you know, and they do lectures and readings all over and so on, which I couldn't do. In fact, the only reason I'm here was that I had a conversation with you on the phone and decided that you were terribly intelligent. And
well, I don't want you to jump to any conclusions about that.
No, put me at my ease, because I'm going to have to, in the next couple of weeks, do some other talk shows where I know that I'm going to have to carry the weight of making a presentation of some kind, which I don't like. You know, it really takes the writer in you and turns you into something else. Some people are awfully good at it. I'm very nervous, because I know that if I went off and did readings, I'd probably be very good, but I'd come back thinking that I was John Lennon. And that wouldn't help me as an artist.
Well, let me ask you a few questions about yourself and in your origins and what got you going. Where are you from?
Originally, Westchester in Massachusetts. And
you were born in Westchester?
Yeah. Grew up in Rye, and then went to boarding school up in Maine, small school.
What kind of family did you have as you grew up?
I'll deal with that in the next novel.
Not even a hint. What's your father? He wasn't a mailman, was he?
No, he wasn't. He's a beautiful man. He worked very close by here at Rockefeller Center,
mm-hmm.
in the Rockefeller Organization, heading up the first philanthropic work that John D. Jr. was doing.
Mm-hmm. A literary household?
Not particularly. No, and before that, it was very heavily evangelical, coming from religion on both sides. And so as a teacher, I've had to check myself from getting too evangelical or too... And I see it in other people, and I'm terribly sensitive to it. If people try to persuade me to read a book or something, immediately I feel that evangelical thing coming in. I just signed a contract to do a book with a trade house to write a book on the history of evangelism, which I'm very excited. The history of evangelism, and especially in this country. Because it fascinates me. I think this country is, for some reason, a prime target for evangelists. And I've worked out my own feelings. I don't have any strong feelings one way or the other about it, except that some of these people are rascals. You can tell it when you look at their faces, you know.
Well, I used to work in little radio stations along the Ohio River, West Virginia, Southeast New Orleans, Appalachia. And I'd always, when I was going to college and right after college, of course, we had these radio preachers who would come in and speak for 30 minutes. So, and two little stations I worked for down there, the general managers would always say, "Now, look, Don, before you let the radio preacher go on the air, you collect his dough. You collect it, you know." So, preacher so-and-so would come in with his entourage, and I would say, "I'm sorry, Reverend, I have to collect the $35 now before you can go on the air." The Reverend, of course, would be indignant, absolutely indignant. He said, "Don't you know we're doing God's work here?" And we'd go around and around. I'd say, "I'm sorry, I just cannot turn on the microphone until you give me the $35. I mean, those are my orders." And so the next 30 minutes would be a 30-minute pitch for funds to the Lord's work.
Yes.
Any rate, it was, and these people would scream and shout and back off from the mic and begin to scream. It was really funny. Those were the days. I guess they're still doing it, when they tested one's moral faith by carrying snakes, poisonous snakes, and defying the snake to bite you, because if it did, you would not display the faith that you needed. I'm aware of the evangelistic fervor.
Yes.
They had tent shows.
Yes.
And you would hear these rantings and ravings and shouts. They were absolutely fascinating. It was like going to another country, another world, a different orbit.
That's right. I'm so glad you're saying this, because this puts a context behind writers' conferences. But sometimes you're up there and you're a published author and you could tell them to jump out a window and they would. It's frightening.
This, I would assume... leads to a lot of the sexual dallying that you refer to.
Well, it's the same in evangelism.
Oh, yes?
Oh, sure. I was trying to research Amy Semple McPherson. What was the film that was done on her 4 or 5 years ago? It was a wonderful film.
Yeah, there was a film. I don't recall the title.
And, of course, there was always the undercurrent. Oh, sure, it's a big undercurrent with all of the evangelists. But I went to one conference, which I didn't mention, and it was up north. And no one had told me that it was sponsored by a religious organization. These were all retired ministers and their wives. And my approach to teaching writing is to try to get people relaxed, because they got to get in touch with their own unconscious or intuition or whatever you want to call it. Well, I started my first lecture, and immediately hands shot up. And they said, "You mustn't get relaxed. The devil will come in." I didn't know what they were talking about. They were all, you know, and they started throwing scripture numbers at me. Well, they had the wrong boy, because I happened to field Bible numbers pretty well, and I shot it right back at them. I suppose there's a lot of the mixture of religion going over into writing. The zeal of the writer feeling that his work is the most important. It's almost the voice of God coming through him and so forth. I don't know why this country is so prone to this stuff. It's people must be so empty for values.
Well, there's also a lot of ignorance and people seeking to find other people to guide them. so it's very easy for
and
them.
You had out of that Ohio Spoon River, that great poet Masters, who came to New York and almost died of poverty. And then I think a year later, the Academy of American Poets gave him $5,000. Spoon River was just a magnificent display of the different lives, the impoverished lives in mid-America. Everything from Ann Rutledge to Lucinda Matlock. Well, we've got a curious attitude towards our writers.
Well, we digress a little bit. Let's go back to you. We got you in, I believe, private school, right?
Yeah.
Where was that?
There's a little school up in Maine, outside of Lewiston, called Hebron. And by the time I got up there, I was sort of going in circles about myself. And fortunately, came under the influence of a teacher who told me to write every day of my life. And he said it didn't matter what it was that I wrote, just so long as I wrote. And I've been doing it ever since. Went to Haverford College, a Quaker college, then transferred out to Stanford. And
what did you study at Haverford?
Philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
Same at Stanford, and went to graduate school at Stanford. I suppose philosophy was a way of keeping the mind working while I was writing poetry on the side.
And when did you graduate from Haverford?
Stanford in 56, and then did graduate work in 60, 61, and then started teaching at NYU at 65, teaching the poetry writing courses, and have been doing that for 20 years, and teaching acting and playwriting at the HP Studios in the city, and occasionally courses at the New School.
How did the New York Quarterly come about?
1969, with some writing students, because we were concerned that there wasn't much in the way of the technical, mechanical approach we were talking about writing. All of the interviews and the journals with writers seemed to be concerned more with their political opinions or with their lifestyles. But I was concerned with things like how Anne Sexton revised her poems, and how Allen Ginsberg wrote first drafts, and things like that. So we started doing interviews.
Yeah, these are very good interviews in the craft of poetry. They have been extremely helpful to me, because a number of the people that I have dealt with
tell you, if you look at the,
are in this book.
The James Dickey interview in that book, at the very end, when he says at the end of his interview, he looks at the tape recorder and he says, "You about finished? You about got what you want?" I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, let me finish up with a little statement, just a very simple, plain statement. Poetry is just naturally the greatest blankety-blank thing in the whole universe." Very close to evangelism. He says, "When you are writing a poem or reading a poem and you've got it all there," he says, there's nothing. Come to compare with the experience of the poetic unity that you can achieve. Well, that's a marvelous statement by James Dickey, but it's very close to religion and to evangelism. I guess a part of me would share that. I know Rilke, the German poet, said, "I don't know what way others may find towards God, but for us, art is the way." It's almost like a priesthood to be an artist or to be a writer and to keep the long pull going. The teaching of it is something else again, which puzzles and fascinates me. I would hope that I would be a little more earnest in my teaching than this fellow in the book, you know. Although he's wearing himself out trying to be nice to people, trying to find interesting things to say about some of these things, which are such some badly written novels and so on. And it does get to be a strain sometimes. I can remember someone we'd interviewed, I asked, "Do you think that the schools unfortunately discourage too many writers?" And this person said, "No, they don't discourage enough. They should discourage more people, keep them from writing, because some people just aren't ready. It's not for them. It's a tough life."
That is the treading on the dangerous possible ground. There have been more people who have been told they are talentless, who have proved that it was just the opposite.
That's
so when you start discouraging people, You may correctly discourage people. That may be so.
Yeah.
But you may take the good ones down in the wash, and it's just something you don't do.
Yeah.
These people are there to learn, and you offer what you can to help them, even if they don't have psychologically, or intellectually, or artistically the ability to go ahead.
Yes. Yes.
Now they're paying their money. They get what they should get what they're paying for.
I agree totally. And I would try to the best of my ability. But you get someone that comes to a conference, they've never seen you before. They don't know whether to trust you or not. And they have 2 weeks, and they have a couple of conferences with you, and you tell them what to do with their work. Now, to me, that's loony. It was like when Freud came over to this country in 1909 to Worcester, Massachusetts, and he came with a few of other of his peers. And they stayed behind in America, and they set up fast mail-order clinics. You know, I'll psychoanalyze you in 2 months. Freud was aghast. He went back to Vienna. He said, this is nonsense. Only America would fall for this kind of thing. I find that the whole circumstances of going to someone that you don't know, I could think of some writers that I would love to go to and perhaps show one or two of my poems to, simply because I know their work. But to go and to go blind and to ask someone, would you criticize what I've devoted 5 years to writing, and on the basis of 2 or 3 conferences, it would be like going to a psychiatrist.
Well, Bill, you could go to the finest writers in the world and show them your work, and if they didn't like it, that wouldn't mean anything.
That's right. That's right.
You want what is frightening? I was thinking about it the other day. I almost went to get my MFA in creative writing at CCNY, because I could do it in the evening, and CBS would pay 80% of the tuition, which wasn't very much anyway. And I figured at this point it was too difficult. It was 2 years ago, 3 years ago. And what worried me, though, was that the thesis, of course, would be a novel or a book of poetry. What happens if your mentor didn't like it?
There you are. There you are. My first reaction is, thank God you didn't go. Because now you're on your own, and what you turn out comes out of raw experience. Mentor, I don't know. You know the history of literature is filled with stories of this kind of thing, of people making mistakes, dreadful mistakes. Emerson was living in Concord with Thoreau. Thoreau published Walden in 1854, and Emerson completely ignored it. Then he wrote that great letter to Whitman, 1855, when Leaves of Grass was published, saying, I welcome you to be... Poor Thoreau. I mean, in a way, it's like comparing Walden to Leaves of Grass, but I think Emerson made a mistake. I think Walden is every bit as great as Leaves of Grass.
Well, things like this happen over and over again. Now, there's a very interesting story dealing with Styron and John Gardner. Several years ago, when Sophie's Choice was published, John Gardner did a front-page review on the New York Times Sunday Book Review and blasted Sophie's Choice.
Yep.
A couple of years ago, Styron called Gardner to ask for permission to reprint that devastating piece of criticism in a book of critical essays published by, I believe, G.K. Hall in Boston, the critical essays on Styron. And Gardner said, yes, you can use it with one condition, that there is a preface or a postscript to the book saying that I repudiate that review because I've changed my mind and I now think that Sophie's Choice is a masterpiece.
Good. Wow. Wonderful. Wonderful.
Styron said, well, it doesn't help me much now. It might have helped a little bit when the book first came out.
Well, it's a tragedy. It's that the New York Times Book Review is held as the great marketplace to get something reviewed in, and I think there's something in the novel. There's a spoof of the New York Times Book Review in the novel of having a picture on the front page and so forth. I mean, what difference does it make? My God, there are so many examples in literature of things falling stillborn from the press and then 10 years, 20 years, 50 years later.
But it's not just the press. It's what any person says about somebody else's work. It may destroy it.
Well,
in the same way that a Broadway critic can destroy a play on Broadway after opening night.
Sure.
But
it's insane, isn't it?
But it really doesn't mean anything because it's an opinion that is not necessarily...
Of course it is. You know, Shakespeare was lying idle for about 80 years until German critics picked him up. And the Germans pointed out and said, this is the greatest poetry, the greatest drama ever written. The English didn't pay that much attention to him during the Restoration. We've got a lot to be proud of with this, or to set oneself up as an arbiter of taste, which I suppose every critic and every teacher does. But there's a tremendous humility that goes along with that. I don't know. I'm teaching a lot of classes now. I think I've got a couple of writing classes that are some of the best I've ever had. But I'm always aware that I can make mistakes.
Yeah, but there are some technical things you can look at. You can see clumsy writing and
sure.
And awkward metaphors and things that just don't belong. Or and plots that are just don't mean anything, that they're ridiculous. You cited some silly plots.
For every James Jones that you get, who is someone who doesn't look, based on his early work, like he's going to go anywhere, you would get also the opposite, which would be a tremendously intelligent, talented person who will never use that talent at all. Maybe they can, it's like in theater where someone can go and do an audition and completely fox you. They're marvelous in the audition. And if you make a mistake of casting them, it's terrible. This is horrible. This is, how do you evaluate talent? How do you do, you can't, of course you can't. You can't do it. And what we think of as greatness comes out of a long period of time. The great broadcasters, we would talk about Edward R. Murrow based on a total body of work in his life, but not one or two broadcasts. I think some of those person-to-person things were silly, but so what? It was with his left hand. What was important?
Yeah, well, he was a pioneer.
Sure.
He did things that nobody else did, and that set him apart. I'm sure there are probably better reporters than Murrow today, but they'll never have the image and prestige that Murrow did, because he did it first.
I'd be perfectly relaxed to be able to say, if you were to hand me now a novel manuscript that you'd written, and I would read it and I would give an objective critique of it, but I would also say, look, you know, I don't know whether this is good or not. I don't. Because partly we go by fashions. What was good in Dreiser's time or Farrell's time would not be marketable today.
Well,
you mentioned Raymond Carver, didn't
yeah.
that? Raymond Carver was when? When was Raymond Carver working?
What do you mean, when?
Is it now?
What are you talking about?
Raymond Carver. You mentioned Raymond Carver's name.
Yeah. I mentioned him as one of the
people that are
who is imitated today. His very minimalist style is very popular with young writers today.
And he was working in the 30s, 20s?
No. Raymond Carver is, Raymond Carver, in fact, is my age. He is affiliated loosely with Syracuse University. He won the Strauss Award or the MacArthur Award. Mm-hmm. You know, they pay him like $250,000, something
yeah.
like that. And he writes poetry, wonderful poetry, usually poetry that is centered around his past as an alcoholic. He has never written a novel. He has written collections of short stories. Mm-hmm. His most recent collection of short stories is called Cathedral. And he writes most of his short story collections have been published by Knopf, and his last poetry collection, which was this year, can't remember the title. He always has long, long titles, and I can never remember them. It's published by Random House.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting man. And I think he's good. I mean, I have to admit that my dabblings are influenced by his writing. And He has such a very small output. You can have a shelf of Raymond Carver material, and it's that wide, everything he's written. But he works over. He rewrites and rewrites and rewrites and pairs and gets it down to the barest possible lines.
Well, I'd say there you are. That's the answer to your question about whether you should have gotten the MFA degree. You're working very well now on your own, using a mentor who's an artist, that you don't necessarily have to meet him or have conferences with him.
Oh, that's true. But I also, since I read vociferously, I also have my own opinions. I mean, I get so many. I go home with shopping bags full of books, and I can look at a book. The unlucky thing for me is that I don't have to review a book on the air if I don't like it.
Yeah.
I don't have to pan a book. It's very seldom that I, in fact, never do a news report on books or writers in which I pan them. It's just not necessary. There's so much junk, mm-hmm. as far as I'm concerned, that I just don't bother with it.
Yeah.
And so much good stuff,
mm-hmm.
or things I'm interested in, that that's my salvation. So it just doesn't stop.
Mm-hmm.
One thing you have to say about literature is that it is so big it's almost overwhelming, because there's always new things to find and new things to discover.
Yeah.
Well, tell me a little more about the New York Quarterly. It's still a going concern, isn't it?
Yes, it went under in 1980-81, just for total lack of money. And I thought that was it. I thought that that was the end of it. I'd given 10 years of my life to doing it. And then in 1983, I got a phone call from someone at the University of Maine, Carol Terrell, who has a foundation, National Poetry Foundation. And he's typical Maine stock. He doesn't talk much. He just said, let's get the New York Quarterly back on the track. I didn't know what he was talking about. I met with him, and then I flew up to Orono to see what his printing facilities were. And we wrote out an agreement that it would be in perpetuity, that Maine would publish and assume all liabilities for the publishing costs. I would assume all overhead expenses down here. So we've been, this is the end of our first year of publishing, and in this economy now,
Is this the first issue?
No, this is the third issue this year. I'm showing you issue 28. And I've tried, now that it's back almost as a gift, while we still have the craft interviews, we still have editorials, I'm trying very hard to get the quality of poetry higher than it was before. And I'm trying to have some fun with the editorials. I'm trying to, as long as we're independent, one of the few independents now going, I don't have any restrictions on me. I can call the shots the way I see them. This editorial is on the nuclear buildup and how it affects poets today to be writing under the possibility that everything might get blown up, and whether they are showing that in their work as much as they might.
Thank goodness it's back. Well, William Packard, I think we could go on and talk, but I think probably the tape is run out now, but I think we covered quite a bit of ground in this 45-minute discussion. I usually try to limit them to 30 because I'm overwhelmed with reams and reams of tape that I have to pare down to two-minute news reports. It's not always easy to do that. But I did enjoy the book, and as soon as I got into it and started reading it, I said, I've got to have him in. I've got to talk to him.
I don't know whether I threw you off that I was more serious than you thought I'd be based on the book.
No, this may be a satire, but I took it seriously, and so I felt it was worth exploring with you and talking in more depth about it.